Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thanks, Stephen. We have 10, 15 minutes or so for questions, should there be demand and inclination and so on. So, again, yes, same format as before. Any sort of comments or questions, if it's sort of aimed at an individual, then please do say so. If it's a little more generally applicable, then that's fine too. So who would like to take the opportunity to ask a question or not? Yes, if you wouldn't mind standing and saying who you are and where you're from as well, please. Thank you.
Right.
I think we need the camera apparently to catch you, if that's all right. Thanks.
I'm Robert Chapman. I come from a place called Ravensbourne in HE. I really wanted to ask Stephen if he would entertain the possibility that Generation Y's approach to problem solving could be better than Ernst & Young's.
Yes. And the things I was saying was not saying that actually Generation Y is wrong. What I was saying is that's the reality of the way of this change. For a while, I think a lot of Generation Y has been a bit emperor's new clothes. There has always been a conflict or you know, dissonance between, you know, a young graduate population. There was when I was a graduate. You know, my managers used to bemoan the way I work. So some of it is a bit, you know, same old, same old. But it is as we start to understand that more, and it is that problem-solving piece. So that means we've got to find ways to actually capture the way that the Generation Y thinks. Because there's a lot of confidence in there. There is a lot of actually willingness, you know, to try new and different ways in thinking and work collaboratively. Some of the difficulties are that actually our exam structures, when I talk about, you know, professional qualifications, you know, it's going to take a while to change those. You know, there are some things where you've just got to get through a massive body of knowledge, and we've got to find ways to, you know, to try and sort of, I guess, meet in the middle. And actually things like a more modularised approach to professional training is part of that. You know, we are changing our graduate induction process, not to find ways of changing Generation Y to mould them into back into baby boomers, but actually how can we work with those individuals? How can we give them less linear career paths? How can we give them the interesting opportunities, yet still be able to run our business profitably? And that's a real challenge. We still need people to do audits. We still need people to spend probably 3 years in assurance to get the right knowledge base before they can be managers. But yes, I agree with you. It's the challenge is actually what changes do you make, what allowances do you make, what can't you change, and how do you get the whole thing to still work properly?
Any further sort of questions or comments? Yeah.
I'm Victoria Critchlow from the Institute of Engineering and Technology. I just wanted to ask Lewis, you talk about peer-to-peer and student ambassadors, but to get the first ones to engage, to then get the organic growth, what is it that motivates that first person or those first group of people to get going on the peer-to-peer?
If we look to students' unions, again, it's where I find that we often have really good examples. I think the misunderstood organisations, because I tried to say that people think they're mainly about representation and campaigning, but actually when you look, a lot of the activity, clubs, societies, volunteering, that's often operated by students' unions. And the good thing about a union is it's a risk-free environment, or relatively risk-free environment. So I think by following your passion, so it's why you look at the RAG model at Loughborough. The guys went in to study engineering, but actually they became passionate about student fundraising. So if they know that they can go into something they're passionate about in a risk-free or relatively risk-free environment, then it creates a circumstance in which they're able to flourish. It's all the cultivation thing. So I think wherever you can do that, wherever you can create the circumstance to allow that to happen, then I think you'll be doing a good thing. And of course the fact that it's student-led also helps. So there's no one coming in and saying it's got to look like this. It's just, well, there's £500, come back in a month and tell us what you've done.
I remember from my students' union days saying that One thing that the student union would say to students were if there's something that you're interested in, and you can either find some other students that are interested in it too, you know, we'll give you a small amount of resource to sort of get you to set off. And if you can't find anyone that's interested in what you're looking to pursue, then we can probably match you up with some other students that that you might not know that have probably come to us with a similar request. And I suspect, in term, you know, so it's not. That's not organic in that sense, but that is you know, providing some collisions that wouldn't otherwise have happened. Did I see a hand? I was rather imagining. No, I wasn't.
Thank you. Alison Clark from the National Association for Student Employment Services. I've got a question for Stephen. Could you tell us, I don't know in where yourself and the 22 staff would have time to do this, but I wonder if you could share with us some of the opportunities you provide for students to gain work experience or to gain exposure to the world of work.
I think this would be for Jenny as well. I mean, you'll know better than I, so the destinations that LSE students go off into, but there's at least a perception that large numbers of them have at least historically gone off into financial services, partly because of the subject mix of the institution, the history and so on. In part kind of motivated by some of the things that you said about the changing perceptions of financial services, but also what sort of data does LSE hold in terms of access to things like internships and work experience, and how easy is it for students that perhaps don't have some of those, or what's the advantage for those that do have the kind of contacts and networks through family and so on? So, Stephen, and then yourself.
Sure. And actually, Philip was on my list of things to talk about, but I thought I was conscious of time, so I left it off. More and more, we are going earlier and earlier. So we now have a programme for picking up sixth formers who will do 6 weeks work experience before they go to university and then come back every year. We are much more active in the first year market, so first years now can have access to a 3-day leadership academy we run. We're doing a spring week this year for the first time for students to engage with. Our summer intern programme, we get over 300 people on our summer intern programme. Our target is that by 2014-15, 50% of our graduate hiring numbers will be filled by some form of early ID programme. So there are lots of opportunities, and we're creating more and more. I think the problem probably from your sat is there aren't enough opportunities because it's very time-consuming and it's very difficult to actually, you know, find the resource in the business, because we want to make sure that people have the right experience and they get something out of it. So you can have too many. I don't think our summer programme will get any bigger, which is why we're looking at many different programmes, because any more than 300 in over summertime, there's just not enough work to do. You know, and it's trying to get all those mixes right. The one thing I will say, and this is something for students, is the students who comes to us in kind of October, November time, they've left it too late. Most of our London vacancies, which are the most popular and biggest vacancies, those pipelines are full. You know, we've closed those vacancies. Now, so what are we at now? So we're middle of November. By the end of this month, there's a few more vacancies still running, and that's because, you know, some of our service line gave us late targets. But by Christmas, we won't be accepting any more applications, even for those harder-to-fill areas. You know, places like Luton and Reading are always difficult. You know, there's satellite offices to London. So students have to engage early and earlier. The challenge is getting the right number of opportunities, you know, that can serve as that demand.
I'll come back to geography in a second, but Jenny.
I mean, I think for in terms of work experience, it's about the quality of the work experience is actually what's important. So in terms of people like Ernst & Young and some of the other large organisations, those kind of personal connections and social capital, if you like, shouldn't really play a part, and I'm sure Stephen and his colleagues would tell me that they don't. What I think is really important is not necessarily, it doesn't have to be work experience, but experiential learning is the important thing, and actually where there aren't work experience opportunities or internships in a field that people want to go into, I mean, I said this to somebody earlier today as well, but I exaggerate, but only a tiny bit, that at LSE, our student population is largely split into two halves, the people that want to own the world and the people that want to save it, right? And the people that want to save the world, it's actually quite difficult to come across kind of formal work experience opportunities in things like think tanks, NGOs, the third sector. So there are a number of things that we can do. One is encourage them to make speculative opportunities and to create those experiences for themselves. And we can help them with that through the networks that we're connected with, through engaging with our alumni, that sort of thing. But also, and you know, to talk about student unions a bit further, is to give them the opportunity to get that experiential learning that they might have got through a spring week in a similar scenario through something they do in the Students' Union. So somewhat terrifyingly, we actually have a subset of one of our student societies who have set themselves up as a pro bono management consultant, and they're going out offering their services to people. Now, actually, probably the experience that they walk away with from that will probably be more valuable than had they gone through a very structured scheme, although they've absolutely got their place, and clearly, you know, they form part of a talent pipeline, and if you want to go and work for one of those organisations, it's always a good idea. But in terms of actual learning outcomes, some of the things that they do through student union societies, whether that's, you know, being treasurer, president, running RAG, or setting yourself up as a pro bono management consultancy, you know, you can't match elsewhere. And so it's about helping them, you know, think about where else can they get that experience that isn't through turning up to an office 9 to 5.
I'm going to tell an example of that. A student I ever hired, and it's quite a few years ago now, his employability skills came from running a market stall on Huddersfield. And I remember the interview vividly because he could talk very articulately about how car boot sales, so this is even before eBay, it shows you how far back I'm going, how car boot sales had destroyed his business. And it just sticks in my mind because he wasn't doing a relevant degree. You know, he just had that commercial instinct. He pulled examples from doing something like, you know, there are great students who pulled examples from, you know, like I say, working on a checkout at Tesco's. Yeah. So it's, I think a lot of it is giving students, where can you get those? It doesn't have to be on a formal programme. You know, half our graduates won't have done a formal programme, but it's actually where can you go and get those behavioural changing experiences.
And I think that's also where employers can come in as well. So one of the things that we've done is completely revamped the way that we do our central careers workshops, employability workshops, in that we looked at what employers were saying, we looked at what the students were saying, we did a survey of alumni saying, you know, what is it that you wished you'd learnt whilst you were still at university. Oddly, the number one skill was we wish we knew how to use Excel properly, but there was a whole set of other things as well. And what we did was we designed a series of workshops and then went out to the market and said to people like Stephen's team, but also to some of the charities, smaller SMEs, some entrepreneurs, actually, look, these are the kind of learning outcomes that our students want. Can you deliver something? And so the win for the employers is that they get the access to the students and to promote their organisation, all the rest of it. And the win from the students is that they've gone away having experienced something and having learnt something that's useful beyond a niche employer or a specific brand name. So I think that's really important in the way that you work. Rather than have people come in, do presentations about why you should work for this organisation, have them come in and teach them something about negotiation skills or how to deal with the merger and acquisition or
one of the things interesting about that, obviously, underlying all of that is an entrepreneurial attitude, which is massively important. That's one of the things that people pick up more and more now. You'll see the number of student businesses, I think, according to What Graduates Do report from 2 weeks ago, it's doubled over the last kind of 7 or 8 years, the amount of graduates setting up their own businesses. It's a small number, but it's increasing. But one of the key things we've got anecdotal information is about alumni. If you speak to alumni fundraising teams, the universities that do this really well, the things that get people to donate big amounts of money isn't, oh, do you remember that lecture that Dr. Chowdhury gave you, or do you remember that brilliant book that you read? No one cares. They don't remember it. But do you remember that experience where you did that thing, where you set up a society, or where you set up your own management consultancy, or where you won the rowing trophy? Those are the kind of things that people actually give to. So it's interesting that I think that if you look in some of the older universities, they're looking at their students' unions not only now as places where they can develop students, but as a brilliant place to connect people back with graduates once they've gone.
I mean, and just linked to that, for some alumni who perhaps, for whatever reason, would rather charitably give elsewhere, they are sometimes more inclined to give their time back to supporting students that have shown a particular interest in their field of work, and I'm sure that's something that you all have come across. A final opportunity for comments and questions. Yes.
Hi, it's a message for Stephen. I've actually written it down here. Do you think the coalition government's abolition of post-study work visas will have a detrimental effect on businesses hiring top-level international talent, and how are organisations such as Ernst & Young addressing this issue?
This is as well, and I'll ask Stephen to answer that question. It's around... So I think lots of people will understandably say there's a lot of value in students having a particular interest and a particular passion and going off and through the Students' Union and through other sort of extracurricular opportunities, go off and lead some charity fundraising or run an event or so on. Of course, and it's great to see that Students' Unions have kind of played a role in supporting that for a number of years, actually, for sort of a couple of decades, really, and if not more. But more recently, there's been a sort of a drive towards the sort of the formal accreditation of that activity. NUS sort of piloted the NUS Student Skills Award. We've seen the establishing of Section 6.1 in the HAAR, which sort of seeks to formally recognise that. Do you think there's a danger that some students might start to shape their activity based on what looks good on 6.1 and so on, rather than what they're sort of potentially kind of interested and inspired by?
I think some students will. I think that's the nature of things. But I think if someone's putting pressure on you in terms of time, you have 10 hours of contact time, then you've got 20 hours in the library. You've got to balance it out. I think you'll do the things that you love because that's what you love doing. You realise that it's better to do something that you love and express that to someone and say, these are the skills I've got, this is how I can demonstrate and articulate them. I didn't do it because the university offered a workshop on it, I did it because I really wanted to just do something in that area. I think that there will be, of course, some students who will do it for kind of utilitarian reasons, but I think more people will do it in a time-sensitive environment because they love it.
Could have come out with a hard times quote. Final reflections on the post-study work. Stephen and Jenny may have a reflection on that because of the demography at LSE.
Short answer is no. It won't change what we do because when we want to hire an international student, we get them a full work visa. We're not really interested in post-study visas. They're too short-term. And if we're going to commit to employing something, we commit properly. My worry about the visa issue, it's sending up the signal that the UK is closed to business for international students, and I think that is more of an issue for higher education institutions. The US found it after 9/11 when they shut the borders, and that directly impacted their universities in a very bad way because, of course, students couldn't get in. If students don't think they'll be able to get work in their host country, in effect, they won't go there because higher education is becoming a commodity. A student who can afford to come and study in the UK is also thinking, well, should I go to the US? Should I go to Australia? Should I go to Germany? And it's more at that end. So I think it will more directly institutions, which subsequently might knock on to the available talent to us. So short term for us, not an issue. Long term, I think there's something in there around the vibrancy and vitality of our institutions being maintained.
And it's interesting that when Australia have made some, who were quite known for having sort of perhaps quite a hostile immigration system, actually have significantly sort of, I wouldn't say relaxed is the right word, but revised the way in which they can allow bright international students to stay in the country, and it's sent out quite a different tone, quite a welcoming tone, and I think we've seen, certainly HEIs have seen a
and
shift.
And the US did that post 9/11 change.
Yes,
a couple of years later, they then changed it because they saw how damaging it was.
I don't know if that's something that LSE have...
I would agree with Stephen. I think that you'll probably see the impact a bit further down the line. And if you look at university admissions, there's already shifts in which countries people are joining them from. I think from my perspective, the thing that's been most disappointing about the current changes in visa is the channels of communication. So we are at the point where, in collaboration with our international student office, is that the Careers Service has created a letter that people can take to employers to explain what the current scenario is. Because it's all very, if you're recruiting on the kind of scale that Stephen is, you know what you're about, you're dealing with it. If you're an SME or you're a startup or you're some sort of smaller organisation, you are not tapped into that level of knowledge, and people are frightened because they're too scared that they might accidentally break the rules, that their knee-jerk reaction is just not to look at people that require work permits. And so I think that's an issue. You know, we are working to educate those people, and AGCAS is doing good work in the area as well. I'm a bit disappointed that actually it's us that are in that position of having to do that education piece when a bit more clarity from Westminster would be good.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.